that I should let her go. She asked me to make her a promise. She asked me to live for her after she was gone, to stop hiding from the world and let myself be happy. She tried to take my hand. She had tears pouring down her cheeks, and she begged me to be happy. For her, if not for me. But instead, I broke down sobbing, and I ran from her touch, from what she wanted from me, because it was impossible. Impossible. I could not say goodbye. I never did. Now it was time for me to ask of her what I couldn't give. I was dying, and I needed her to live for me. I stood by her bed, holding myself because I felt like, at any moment, my skin might open up and pour my dying guts out onto the floor. I gazed down at her sleeping face. She looked like me now, almost identical. We'd never looked alike, not one day in our entire lives. She'd always been a shrunken, distorted version of me, a homunculus. But now we were the same. She was me, and I was her. But there was so much life in her now, more than she needed. I could feel the life radiating off her like heat off a sunburn. I had given her too much, I thought. I should have kept a little of that life for me, because now I was the one dying. What if I could take just a little of what I'd given to keep us together? I reached a hand toward her arm, but didn't touch her. Stopped within an inch of her. Still, I could sense the flow of energy trapped beneath her skin. The delicious medicine inside her, of which she now had an excess. My skin seemed to stretch toward her, strands of me unraveling as they had done in the basement. I looked down at my hand and saw stretching threads of light emerge from my palm. I tried to will them to shrink back into me, but my stomach lurched and the invisible pincers at my skin bit deeper, and I couldn't stop. The pain drove my rational mind into hiding, so all that was left was need and desperation. Erin's eyelids began to flutter. She whimpered, and I startled back from the bed, gasping, curling my hands into fists. The spell I'd been under was temporarily broken. The filaments of light that had emerged to connect me to my twin were gone, but I could feel them struggling to break free. I tightened my fists until my fingernails dug into my palms. Erin's brow furrowed tightly, creating a row of wrinkles between her eyes. Her eyelids twitched rapidly. She whimpered again and muttered something under her breath. I leaned closer to hear. "Don't hurt her," she cried softly. "Please stop it. Please don't hurt my mom. No, 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 no." Erin began to thrash wildly on the bed, arms flailing, fighting against some unseen enemy. But I knew the enemy's name. Thomas Dunn. Trapped in her dream, my sister screamed. "Erin, Erin, it's okay, it's just a dream," I tried to tell her, but she was still caught between waking and dreaming. Footsteps pounded toward the room. The door burst open, and a frantic nurse with her hair falling out of a ponytail charged inside. "What's wrong?" my mom asked, awake and sitting up now, climbing out of bed. "She's having a nightmare," I said quickly, guiltily. "It's okay, it's just a nightmare." As though these words reached through her sleep, Erin's eyes flashed open, huge and alarmed, unfocused and confused. And then they found me, and her face crumpled. A howl of misery escaped from her throat. "I want to forget. I want to forget all of it, Kenna." She choked on the words and began to cough and cry at the same time. She curled into the fetal position and hid her face in the pillow as her body was racked with sobs, each one a tiny, desperate shriek. I swallowed a taste like acid from my mouth. The nurse administered a sedative through Erin's IV, and a moment later my sister's torment faded as she slipped back into unconsciousness. I hoped she wouldn't dream again. I hoped she'd find some way to forget, even though I knew that was impossible. The nurse left with an admonition that I needed to let Erin rest, and I turned to face my mom. I felt exposed, a hunted animal that has run out of cover. Sweat beaded on my forehead, slicked my spine, but my teeth chattered and my skin shriveled against the air, like I'd stepped inside a freezer unit. My eyes found my mom's, and I saw in them the knowledge of what I was about to say. "It's happening again." Her expression showed no surprise, only dismay. It was like she'd been waiting for me to say the words. Still, it shocked me when she ripped off the tape keeping her IV needle flat to her wrist, and then carefully slid the needle from her arm. "We need to get out of this hospital," she said. "Is Blake still here?" I averted my eyes and shook my head. I told him to leave. I was afraid I would. I didn't finish. Didn't need to. "Call him," she told me. "Tell him to come right away and pick us up. Not at the front entrance, though. We need to leave without being seen. There's an exit along the side of the hospital." She set the IV tubing aside and plucked at her hospital gown. "And ask him to bring me some of his mom's clothes." The Road to Somewhere. I peeked my head out the side exit and glanced left to right in the alley where Blake had parked. There were some delivery guys at a loading dock farther down the back of the building, but they weren't paying attention. Other than them, we were alone.
"Are you okay?"
Blake asked, climbing out of his 4Runner, his brow so deeply furrowed I thought he might develop permanent worry lines by the time this was all over, if it were ever over. At least he seemed to have forgiven me for yelling at him in the cafeteria and sending him away. "Not really," I admitted. I was past the point where lying would do me any good. I met his eyes. It wasn't easy. "Thanks for coming back," I said. He nodded, and I held the door open for my mom, who still wore her hospital gown and a white bathrobe. "Blake," she said in greeting.
"Hi, Anya,"
Blake said, an uncomfortable smile flickering on his lips. My mom insisted Blake call her by her first name, even though Blake was a staunch believer in calling all adults Mr. or Ms. Blake looked past my mom.
"Where's Aaron?" he asked.
I hadn't had time to explain much to Blake over the phone.
"She's staying,"
my mom answered curtly, ending the inquiry. She'd left a note for Aaron with a vague explanation that we'd gone out to get a few things. Our sudden departure was sure to raise alarms among the police and hospital staff, but my mom assured me that it was imperative we leave as soon as possible, and I couldn't disagree with her.
"Where to?"
Blake asked when Mom and I were huddled in the back seat, beneath a blanket so the reporters wouldn't spot us as we drove away.
"Take the Alta Highway into the mountains," Mom said. "I'll tell you where to go once we reach the summit."
"Okay."
There was uncertainty in his voice, but he did as he was told. When we were a mile away from the hospital, Mom threw back the blanket. I sat up and rubbed my temples. The sound in my ears had abated slightly now that we were out of the hospital. I wondered if it was the presence of so many people that made it worse. The fever chills and stabbing stomach cramps and prickling on my skin continued, but were also slightly less intense than they had been inside the building. Blake handed my mom a paper grocery bag.
"I brought some of my mom's clothes. I'm not sure they'll fit, but it was the best I could do."
"Thank you." Mom opened the bag and pulled out a pair of sneakers with balled-up socks stuffed inside, yoga pants, a university t-shirt, and a gray hoodie. Blake kept his eyes trained carefully on the road as my mom changed. When she pulled her hospital gown over her head, exposing her naked back, I got the first good look at her tattoo I'd had in years. She kept it carefully covered, never wearing tank tops or bathing suits. Now I took the opportunity to examine the tattoo carefully while her back was to me. The inked drawing was intricate, obviously created by a gifted artist. I saw now that the wings on her shoulder blades were only a part of the tattoo, that there was an entire mural covering her skin. There was a depiction of a large house on her lower back, and forested mountains in the background. The phases of the moon stretched the length of her spine, transitioning into the moth's thorax and head. The moth itself had black eyes and perfect black circles in the centers of its wings. It seemed to tell a story, one that my mom had certainly never told to me. She pulled the t-shirt over her head, ending my scrutiny.
"That's better," she said, wadding up the hospital gown and shoving it into the paper bag.
She turned her head toward the window and gazed out at the dwindling houses, now being overtaken by forest as the highway wound into the foothills of the Cross Pine Mountains.
"Mom, where are we going?" I asked,
and then lowering my voice, even though there was no way to keep Blake from hearing. Are you taking me to the same place as last time?
What place?
Blake asked, glancing at me in the rearview mirror. My mom drew in a long breath and released it. No, she said, and looked at her hands in her lap. I'm taking you where I should have taken you a long time ago. I made a mistake, Kenna. She rubbed her eyes and then stopped rubbing and left her hands there, covering her face. I thought if you didn't know about them, you would never become one of them. But I was wrong. I was wrong about so many things. I stared at her, mouth parted, my heartbeat frantic. I don't understand. She took another deep breath, lowered her hands, and looked at me. You will. Soon enough, you'll understand everything. Blake's car crested the summit. At the top of the mountain, we had a view of the bucolic valley on the other side of Cross Pine Range, all verdant forest and rippling fields of tall grass, no cities or towns, or even a gas station in sight. From this vantage point, the rest of the world might as well not exist. The volume on Blake's stereo was turned down low, but I heard the faint strains of the band that had been playing last night when we arrived at the festival. Long Way Home. As we stared down the other side of the mountain, I had the distinct feeling it would be a very long way home, and I had no idea who I would be when I returned. Pull over here, Mom said when we reached the base of the mountain. Blake slowed and veered onto the shoulder of the highway. I was about to ask why we'd stopped when I saw the narrow, rutted dirt road, barely a road, more of a path, leading off through a field and then disappearing into another row of mountains. My mom put her hand on Blake's shoulder. Blake, I hate to ask, but would it be all right if you waited here while we took your car the rest of the way? Mom, I said, shocked that she would even consider such a thing. You can't ask him to just sit on the side of the road until we get back. The people I'm taking you to see are extremely private, she said, and opened the door as though the decision were already made. For a moment, Blake and I were alone in the car. He sat facing forward, hands clenched on the steering wheel. He loved his 4Runner. He'd saved up and bought it himself, and he cared for it like it was a prized Bentley, washing it every weekend and using special cloths on the paint. I'll do it, he said. I'll stay behind. Blake, no. Just no. You won't even let me drive your car. I don't care about the car, he said quietly. I care about you. I want to help, and it seems like this is the only way I can. He twisted in his seat to face me, and for a moment we looked at each other and said nothing, but I could read the frustration in his eyes and in his furrowed brow. He looked older than he had yesterday. I guessed I probably did too. I don't understand any of this, he said. That makes two of us. I hope your mom knows what she's doing. The protective edge to his voice told me he didn't trust my mom as much as he pretended to. Still, when Mom knocked on Blake's window, he opened the door and got out, leaving his keys in the ignition and the car running. Mom climbed into his seat, and I got out and dragged myself reluctantly to the passenger side and got in. I'll be back before nightfall, my mom told Blake. I couldn't help but notice she said I, not we. But just then a lightning bolt of pain lanced through my guts, and I decided not to question her. Blake shoved his hands in his pockets. No problem. He looked at the ground and kicked at a clump of grass with the toe of his sneaker. I wished I could kiss him goodbye, hug him, something, anything. Nothing changes, he had said last night after our kiss. Or everything does. That had been my response, but I had no idea how possible that was. Blake opened his mouth to say something more to me, but he never got the chance. My mom put the car in drive and pulled onto the dirt road. In the rearview mirror, I watched Blake until he disappeared, my throat swollen with sadness. I managed not to cry, but only because the grinding pain in my guts and the ache in my bones was a handy distraction from my overwhelming emotions. He'll be okay, Mom said after we'd been bouncing and lurching down the overgrown dirt road for a few minutes in silence. She glanced over at me. You really like him, huh? Can we talk about something else?
like where we're going? I assume you didn't want to tell me in front of Blake. She was silent for a moment before nodding.
It's better that no one knows.
She took a breath and exhaled the answer.
I'm taking you to Eclipse.
Eclipse? I repeated, assuming for a moment that I'd heard her wrong. Eclipse was a place everyone who'd grown up in Rushing was aware of, but no one I knew had ever actually been there. I had seen people from Eclipse in town before, but only a few times when they made runs to the post office or hardware store or the gas station. They rarely left their isolated commune tucked away in the mountains, and were, as far as I knew, almost entirely self-sufficient and off the grid, and had been for several decades.
Why?
I asked after this announcement had sunk in. The last thing I needed was to be around people, and I doubted the residents of Eclipse wanted anything to do with me.
Because.
Her grip on the wheel tightened. I could see the strain all the way up to her neck.
I think they can help you. I hope they can. Or will.
Why would they be able to help me? My mom chewed her lip.
Mom, please,
I said sharply, holding myself to control a sudden bout of fever chills.
Don't make me beg for every answer.
Okay, I'm sorry. She looked at me with her eyes swimming, and I knew she meant it.
It's hard to talk about after all these years. There's so much I never told you about where I came from, about the Calyptra. That's what they call themselves, the people who live at Eclipse.
Calyptra, I repeated. I was fairly certain I'd never heard the word before, but that wasn't surprising. Pretty much the only thing people in Rushing knew about those who lived at Eclipse was that they existed.
What does that mean?
I asked.
Nothing. It's just a word.
I narrowed my eyes at her, trying to decide if she was lying to me, but I couldn't be sure either way. We hit a pothole and both of us jolted forward in our seats.
It's a good thing Blake has an SUV, Mom said. I forgot how rough this road is.
So you've been to Eclipse? I had 1,000 more questions, but before I could ask the next in line, Mom began to slow the forerunner. We had reached something man-made, a gated fence made of barbed wire and 2x4s, closing off the narrow road wedged between two jutting hills. I blinked in surprise when I caught sight of a man sitting on the other side of the fence, lounging against the trunk of a maple tree and picking lazily at the strings of a banjo. He wore a faded chambray shirt tucked into jeans, and his dark, tousled hair grew wild over his neck and ears. As Mom rolled toward the gate, the man set his instrument aside, rose and approached the fence, his air of relaxed indifference slipping away. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up to his elbows, and as he folded his arms over his chest, I saw tan, muscled forearms flex. Even from yards away, I could gauge the intensity of his blue eyes, sapphires fringed by inky lashes. Mom braked in front of the gate, which was closed and secured with a softball-sized padlock. Several large wooden signs were propped against the fence, making declarative statements like, "Absolutely no trespassers allowed," and "Unwelcome visitors will be treated as such."
"Is he one of the Calyptra?"
I asked. He didn't look much older than me, probably in his early 20s.
"Yes, his name is Cyrus."
I glanced at her, wondering how often she came to Eclipse that she recognized this man on sight.
"He doesn't look very friendly," I observed. "I told you, the Calyptra don't like visitors," Mom said. "But don't worry, I'll handle him."
She was out the door before I could argue. I watched her approach the fence. When he saw who she was, his lips parted, and for a moment he only stared at her. But he recovered quickly from whatever shock she'd delivered, shook his head, and pointed back up the road. I figured he had just told her to go back where she came from, or something of that nature. His expression was stony, unaffected. But then Mom said something that took him aback. His eyes widened, and he looked directly at me. My heart began to pound, and the back of my neck grew hot under his stare. Then he reached into his shirt and pulled out a long leather thong, on the end of which hung a key. As he unlocked the padlock and opened the gate, Mom climbed back into the forerunner. Her hand shook as she shifted into drive.
"What did you tell him?"
I asked.
"That I needed to see Rebecca." Who's Rebecca?
My mom eased her foot down on the gas pedal, and we proceeded through the open gate. I locked eyes with Cyrus for a moment as we passed him, and I felt my temperature rise again.
Rebecca is the person who founded Eclipse, Mom said, glancing at me before adding, she's also your grandmother. Eclipse.
I gaped at my mom, forgetting momentarily about the torment my body was in. Then the questions piled out of me, one after another.
I have a grandmother and you never told me? Does she know about Aaron and me? Why hasn't she ever come to see us? What's she like?
I paused to catch my breath, and another realization hit me.
You're from Eclipse, aren't you? That's why you never talk about your past. You didn't want us to know.
She simply nodded, keeping her eyes trained on the road.
But why?
Her face pinched as though she were recalling a painful memory.
Rebecca, my mother, and I are not on good terms. She never forgave me for choosing a normal life over life with the Calyptra.
But it's not like you went far. You're just on the other side of the mountain.
To Rebecca, that might as well be the other side of the world. As far as she's concerned, I died the day I left.
That's extreme.
That's Rebecca.
Her eyes flicked toward me, troubled.
You and she are a lot alike, you know.
No, I don't know. You'll have to actually tell me since I've never met her.
Mom sighed. The way you take everything to extremes, the way you obsess. You can never do anything in moderation. It's all or nothing with both of you.
I sat back heavily in my seat. This was the most honest conversation I'd had with her in years, and I wasn't sure I liked it. Not that she was telling me anything I didn't already know, but it still bothered me to hear myself assess this way.
Well, you're not perfect either, I told her.
She nodded.
I know that.
You're sad all the time, and you're secretive, and I feel like I don't even know you.
She sighed and deflated, and I wished I'd kept my mouth shut. I was lashing out at her because it was the only thing I could do.
Ahead, the mountains opened into fields. The road wound through an orchard and then past rows of grapevines clinging to posts. I spotted a few people, women with long, intricate braids and shaggy-haired men in tunics, picking fruit from trees and vines. As we drove past, their eyes followed us, stunned and apprehensive. I craned around in my seat to see what they'd do, and glimpsed Cyrus trotting along beside us on the road, the banjo slung onto his back. He waved to the people in the orchard, signaling that we were okay. I exhaled a pent-up breath, wondering what those people would have done if Cyrus hadn't waved them off. I remembered the sign by the fence. Unwelcome visitors will be treated as such. After what my mom had just told me, I wasn't sure what kind of visitors that made us. Would Rebecca, my surprise grandmother, turn us away? Maybe she would take one look at my mom and decide all had been forgiven. I felt a thrill of wary excitement at the prospect of meeting a family member who hadn't existed to me until minutes ago. But the aching emptiness inside me sucked it away and left me feeling hollow. The deeper into Eclipse territory we drove, the more attention we attracted, until we had a dozen Calyptra following us. We passed a smattering of stone-cobbled outbuildings, greenhouses, gardens, storage sheds, a large A-frame barn, and an elaborate patchwork yurt. There were fenced animal paddocks enclosing horses, cows, sheep, and goats, and several large chicken coops. Mom had to progress slowly because chickens and wild turkeys waddled into the road, unmindful of the tires about to flatten them. Then we crested a grassy hillock, and I sucked in a breath as the house depicted in ink on my mom's lower back appeared before us. A sprawling three-story chalet, like something you'd find high in the Alps. At the very top of the chalet, a broad balcony looked out across the valley. A woman with thigh-length blonde hair, wearing a long lavender dress, stood on the balcony alone. She stared down at us a moment before turning and disappearing through the balcony door. That was her, wasn't it? I said.
That was Rebecca.
Yes, Mom said softly.
That was my mother.
We pulled up alongside an old pickup truck parked next to a shed.
Mom killed the engine and we sat in silent awe for a moment as we gazed out the windshield at the wooden castle bursting from the middle of this remote valley, walled in by mountains on all sides.
I forgot how big it is, Mom said, sounding breathless.
As soon as we stepped out of the car, we were surrounded. The people who'd been following the Forerunner converged on us, more heading in our direction from across the yard. With their proximity, the shuddering in my ears increased, and my fever ramped up several degrees. Sweat trickled down my back, and I went stiff. I could feel their energy, their life, like I was standing next to a bonfire. It was as palpable as steam in the air.
It's all right, Mom said, sensing my tension. They won't hurt us.
That's not what I'm worried about, I muttered, my jaw aching from clenching my teeth. My mom looked at me, her expression calmer than I expected.
You can't hurt them, Kenna. They're like you. Or you're like them, I suppose. You are Calyptra.
My lips parted and a breath escaped. My eyes darted to the assembled people and then back to my mom. I licked my lips nervously.
Are you sure?
Yes, she said. But stay in control a little longer. You can still hurt me. I blinked at her, confused, but my mom turned away, offering no explanation. Questions reeled through my head. My mom had lived here, and her mother was Calyptra. So how was my mom not like me?
I surveyed the assembled.
The Calyptra represented a gamut of ethnicities. Asian, Latino, Indian, African-American, and ranged in age from early 20s to middle age, although they all possessed an ageless quality. The longer I looked at them, the more difficult it was to estimate their ages. But I didn't see a single child among them. Their clothing was somewhere between rustic and bohemian, loose linen tunics with jeans, peasant skirts and camisoles, long dresses with bell sleeves, cargo pants, brown boots, chambray and plaid flannel shirts. The women, for the most part, sported hair that draped to their waists, the men's to their shoulders. I remembered the droves of colorfully dressed faux hippies who'd gathered en masse at Folk Yeah Fest. At the time, I'd thought them stylish and reasonably authentic, but compared to the Calyptra, they seemed more like children playing dress-up. What struck me most about the Calyptra, though, was the glow of vitality they exuded, which I could not only see but feel. They were otherworldly in their bright-eyed loveliness, like flowers picked at their zenith of perfection. Their skin was flawless and natural, their hair glossy, and their bodies lean and athletic in a way that even people who spent their lives at the gym could rarely achieve. Whatever naturalistic lifestyle they were living out here, it was working for them.
Anya, is it you?
A man with thick golden hair, a pointy beard, and the physique of Thor shouldered his way to the front. I shrank from him and hid behind my mom. He looked like he could have picked both of us up by the backs of our necks, one in each hand, and tossed us like kittens.
Stieg, Mom said, smiling uncertainly and nodding.
You haven't changed a bit. It is you.
The big man, Stieg, said in a tone of wonder, looking my mom up and down while the other Calyptra gasped and whispered behind their hands.
I hardly recognize you. Willkommen him,
Stieg said in what sounded like a Scandinavian dialect, Norwegian or Danish. I had no idea what his words translated to, but I hoped not get the hell out before we throw you out. Then he threw his arms around my mom in a hug and lifted her off her feet.
I knew you'd come back one of these days.
There was a sing-song quality to his voice that made him sound like a cheerful bird. He released my mom and put his hands on his hips, still grinning. I released the breath I was holding, relieved that he wasn't about to toss us off Eclipse property. But when his eyes turned to me, the smile dissolved.
You bring a stranger into our midst,
Stieg said, his musical voice growing flat.
Why?
This is my daughter, Kenna. Mom said, her chin tilting up defiantly.
She may be a stranger, but she's still Calyptra.
Mom lowered her voice so only Stieg could hear.
I need to see Rebecca. It's urgent.
She nodded to indicate me, and added, her voice barely audible, "She's culled the forbidden anima. She's going through catharsis."
"Catharsis?"
I blinked at my mom, wanting to ask what she was talking about, but before I could open my mouth, Stieg clapped so loudly the sound stung my ears.
"All right, everyone, back to work. Plenty to do before sundown."
There were a few grumbles, but the crowd dispersed, heading back to the gardens and fields, most of them craning their necks to peer at my mom and me over their shoulders. Stieg ushered us toward the house.
"Rebecca's inside. I'm sure she'll be happy to see you."
Mom snorted derisively. "No need to lie to me, Stieg. I'm a big girl now. I can handle my mother." Judging from the slight tremor in Mom's voice, I wasn't so sure she believed what she said. Rebecca. Stieg led us through corridors that twisted and turned and split. The immense building could have been designed by a rabbit. It seemed more Warren than house. The walls, floor, and ceiling were exposed wood, oily and aged. Ethereal paintings of moths with black circles on white wings crowded the walls and the hallways. The same species of moth that was inked on my mom's back. "What kind of moth is that?" I asked. Hearing my question, Stieg glanced over his shoulder and gave my mom a look that I didn't know how to interpret as anything other than a warning.
"It's an eclipse moth," my mom said, and then quickly added,
"but it isn't real. That is, it doesn't exist. It's like a fairy tale creature."
"Then what's with the obsession?"
Mom shrugged. "Eclipse moths are the Calyptra's totem, sort of a mascot or a family crest." I guess there was more to the story, but Mom didn't seem keen on talking about it in front of Stieg, so I let it drop. We turned a corner and Stieg nearly collided with a girl heading fast in the opposite direction.
"Pardon me," she started to say, and then she saw my mom and froze with her mouth open. She had skin the color of brown sugar and long, silky black hair woven into an intricate braid that hung to her elbows. Her fierce eyes were small and dark, like black pearls.
"It's you," the woman said, breathless and flustered, blinking rapidly.
I mean, you're not supposed to be here."
"I know." Mom lowered her eyes as though in shame. "Joanna, this is my daughter, Kenna." Joanna's eyes cut to me and widened. For a long moment, all she did was stare at me.
"She has gray hair," she said finally.
"It's not her natural color," Mom said, a sardonic crackle to her tone. She'd been coolly furious when she saw what I'd done to my blonde hair.
"Why would anyone dye their hair gray?" Joanna asked in clear abhorrence.
Mom shrugged, as if to say, "Teenagers, who knows why they do anything?" Joanna continued to study me, and her brow furrowed.
"What's wrong with her?" she asked.
But the apprehension in her voice told me she was not referring to my hair. I shuddered and clutched myself. The respite I'd enjoyed was over, and my fever chills and aching body were ramping up again. I realized my teeth were chattering, my lungs felt hardened and shrunken, and my insides felt like they were caving in, like my ribcage would buckle and my organs and bones would fold into themselves like a collapsing universe. At the same time, parts of me seemed to be unraveling, trying to reach out for whatever, whoever was near me, hair-thin veins trying to connect to something vital, something that could end my suffering. It hadn't been this bad after Jason Dunn. If it had, I didn't think I would have survived.
"Catharsis?" Joanna guessed before Mom could answer.
"I'm taking her to Rebecca," my mom said in confirmation. "She needs help, and I can't give it to her." Again, Mom lowered her eyes.
"Not the way I am now."
Joanna's black pearl eyes darted to Stieg, and then back to my mom. She seemed to be trying to decide something.
"You should leave," she blurted with sudden, forceful hostility. "Rebecca doesn't care about you or your mongrel daughter. Just get in your car and go."
My mom looked like she'd been slapped. Even Stieg appeared surprised by the vehemence in Joanna's dismissal.
"Joanna," he said, shocked. It's not your place to speak for Rebecca.
My mom shook her head. I don't expect anyone to welcome me with open arms, least of all my mother.
She fixed her eyes on Joanna, and something unspoken passed between them.
I thought you might be different, Joanna. I guess that was too much to hope for.
Joanna's jaw clenched and her hands fisted at her sides. But what I saw in her eyes when she looked at my mom wasn't anger or loathing. There was affection in them, deep and unmistakable. And she seemed to be pleading with her eyes for my mom to take me and leave. But I couldn't be sure, and a moment later she turned on her heel and hurried away. My mom stared after Joanna with tears brimming in her eyes. I'd seen my mom sad. She was almost always sad. But I'd never seen her heartbroken, and that was how she struck me now. I turned to my mom.
How do you know her? Or him, for that matter?
I nodded at Stieg.
How long has it been since you left Eclipse?
A long time, she answered vaguely.
But you must have been back to visit.
Neither Joanna nor Stieg looked older than 25. Stieg and my mom shared another of those secretive glances.
No, she said. Never.
I wanted to know more about this time discrepancy, but I had my own issues with time right now, mainly that I was running out of it. That reaching, unraveling feeling was getting stronger, and it seemed to be stretching toward my mom. I wiped sweat from my brow with the back of a trembling hand, teeth still chattering as violently as if I'd just climbed out of a frozen river in January.
Fine. Whatever we're doing here, let's get back to it. I don't know how much longer I can hold on.
Of course, my mom said, snapping back to reality and squaring her shoulders, as though she were about to go into battle.
Stieg led us to a steep staircase, and we began to climb. When we reached the third floor, we came to a closed wooden door, a pattern of branches and moons and fluttering moths carved on the surface. Stieg knocked softly.
Rebecca, come in.
The response was immediate, as though she'd been waiting patiently for our arrival. Stieg pushed the door open, revealing cozy quarters that seemed to be part bedroom, part study, with a vaulted ceiling and exposed beams, hung with colorful tapestries and lanterns. The walls were jammed with framed art, antique stringed instruments, and bookshelves. Fur rugs were scattered across the floor, the biggest lying in front of a fireplace with a stone hearth, surrounded by large, fluffy sitting pillows. Two large skylights let in shafts of lemony morning sun. The first person my eyes locked onto when I entered was Cyrus, standing in front of a rustic birch wood desk, talking to the woman sitting behind it. When I saw her, everyone else in the room faded. I had to blink when she turned her face toward me, like I'd looked directly at the sun. Her smooth skin was the color of dark honey, and a cape of caramel blonde hair cascaded past her waist to the tops of her thighs. Her arms were slender, waifish, and multitudes of silver rings circled her fingers. Her face was almost too beautiful to make sense. Wide-set, pale eyes, shell-pink lips, an aristocratic nose and chin, and high, round, peachy cheekbones. She was nothing you'd think of when you think of a grandmother, but I knew on sight that this woman was mine. She rose and glided toward me, smiling, but didn't spare so much as a glance for my mom. Her bare feet whispered across the wood floor, and the gauzy fabric of her long, lavender dress fluttered around her ankles.
You must be my granddaughter, she said. I'm so glad to finally meet you.
I wanted to tell her to stay back, not to touch me. Even though my mom said I couldn't hurt these people, the Calyptra, I didn't want to take any chances. But Rebecca smiled at me so gently, and there was a welcoming glow to her, like she'd been waiting for me all these years. Like maybe just by looking at me, having never met me, she loved me. This air of acceptance overwhelmed me, and I couldn't speak. She cupped my cheeks and hands as soft as baby skin.
I'm Rebecca, she said.
Then my ears filled with a shuddering roar, and my skin pulsed, one pounding heartbeat reverberating through me, before I felt myself unravel, strands of me reaching for her, for my mom, for anyone at all, reaching to pierce their skin and drink the life inside them. With an animal cry, I tore away from Rebecca, from all of them, and backed against the wall. "I can't," I said, breathing fast, though no oxygen seemed to reach my lungs. "I can't hold on any longer." I looked down at my body and saw slivers of white filament extended from me, threads of pale light waving and twisting, seeking purchase. With my back against the wall, I slid to the floor, arms wrapped tight around me as though I could hold myself together. But my body was rebelling, and no matter how hard I willed the veins of light to withdraw back into me, they refused. Instead, they grew, reaching for my mom. I shut my eyes tight and covered my head with my hands, unable, unwilling to watch what was about to happen. "Get away from me, all of you," I shouted at them, and I hoped they listened, even though knowing what I'd done to the land around my home, I didn't know if it would do them any good. But I didn't hear any of their footsteps retreating from me. There was only Rebecca's voice, calm and assured and in control. "Cyrus, fetch one of the jars. Quickly, please." My entire body quaking, I dared to peek up at them and saw Cyrus throw open a cabinet on the far side of the room, removing a ceramic container. He handed it carefully to Rebecca, and she moved closer to me until I saw it was some kind of jar in the shape of an animal's head. A sheep's head, I realized when she was only a few feet away. She continued to ease closer to me with the jar held out in front of her. "Please," I begged, my words vibrating through my trembling throat, strands of me reaching to engulf her. "Get away." She kept moving closer, her eyes never leaving mine. Then she knelt and set the jar in front of me. I stared at the jar, and the sheep's head with its blank eyes stared back. "Open it," Rebecca commanded. Her voice filled with so much authority that I had no choice but to do what she said. I opened the top of the lamb's head. Again, I felt that sense of unraveling, like a ball of yarn dropped down a staircase, with someone still holding the string at one end. The pale veins extruded from me, stretching and surrounding the opening at the top of the jar, as a fine white cloud of light drifted from inside. The veins hoarded the light and wrapped around it, and as the white cloud diminished, the emptiness inside me was filled. My lungs eased and my bones ceased aching. The fiery itching on my skin stopped, and the shuddering sound in my ears quieted to blessed silence. When the cloud was gone, the pale veins withdrew into me, and I slumped against the wall and fell instantly, blissfully, asleep. This Side of the River. I dreamed of Blake. I stood on one side of a river, its rippling waters tinseled with moonlight, and he was on the other. My bank was lush with blossoming trees and a carpet of white flowers bathed in milky moonlight. But Blake's side was dark, as though the forest behind him had recently burned, and the light did not reach it. He tried to tell me something, but the crashing roar of water drowned his voice. Then the river began to rise, pushing us farther and farther from each other, until he was only a sliver in the distance, and I had forgotten his name. I woke in an unfamiliar bed, and the dream lingered for a moment like a bad aftertaste, before dissolving into the basement of my subconscious. Though it was dark in the room, and my eyes had not yet adjusted, I didn't need them to tell me I was not alone. I tensed, sitting up quickly, willing my groggy head to clear, and then realized that I wasn't groggy at all. My head was clear. My body felt normal, better than normal, in fact. It felt freaking amazing, both physically and mentally. The pain and sickness that had racked me were gone. I didn't think I'd ever known such a sense of perfect, untroubled serenity. It was like every worry and fear and the mound of guilt I'd harbored had been locked away in a safe room inside my head, still there, but unable to touch me for the time being. I recalled what had happened before I'd plunged into sleep, meeting Rebecca, losing control and becoming undone. The sheep's head jar and the white cloud of light that had been trapped inside it. The pale, glowing veins that had emerged from me and siphoned it into my body. What had that light been?
Whatever it was, I could feel it inside me still. A crystal glaze over every thought and feeling. A soothing balm that filled up the emptiness and drove away my pain. I was healed. The gnawing, aching, unbearable hunger that had been a constant torment since I'd woken in the basement was gone. But where was I now? And who was in the room with me?
Mom? I tried. Are you there?
She's gone, said the person in the room, who I still could not see. I heard a scraping sound, and then an orange flame burst to life, illuminating Rebecca's stunning face in a warm glow. She lit an oil lamp on the bedside table, and the room filled with amber light. I took in my new surroundings. I was in a bedroom that was small but cozy. The bed was built into the wall, and the walls, floor, and ceiling were made up of planks of wood, like the inside of a cabin. There was a large cast-iron stove that looked more like a pot-bellied steampunk robot next to the bed, and a colorful woven rug on the floor. The walls were bare, as though this room had never been occupied, or as if the former occupant had moved out and taken all of her things. My eyes returned to Rebecca's.
"What do you mean she's gone?" I asked.
Rebecca sat in a chair across from me, but she leaned forward to take my hands in hers. Her proximity alarmed me until I remembered that whatever affliction I'd been suffering for the last few hours was cured. My grandmother, who looked to be no older than 40, although that couldn't be her true age since my own mom was near 40 herself, tilted her head, brow furrowing in sympathy. "She went home. You're to stay here with us for the time being."
"She left me here?"
How could she abandon me with a bunch of strangers, even if one of them was my grandmother? I was aware of a distant sense of distress, but it lay beneath the tranquil glaze that covered my emotions like a cool silk sheet. "For now," Rebecca said, reaching out and smoothing back my hair. She lifted a lock of it, and I saw that my hair was no longer the ash gray I had colored it, but a smooth butterscotch blonde. I picked up a lock of my hair and studied it.
"How did this happen?"
"Anima," my grandmother said simply, as though I should understand. But she saw my confused expression and smiled. "It has restored your body to its natural state." "Well, not natural. I suppose ultimate is a more appropriate word. Your mother really never told you anything, did she?" I started to shake my head, and then stopped and lowered my gaze to the patchwork quilt covering my legs. "She tried once," I said, remembering when I was 10 years old, and my mom had found me in the yard, sobbing so hard I could barely breathe. She had taken me in her arms and comforted me until I'd calmed enough to tell her what was wrong. Erin was sick again, and even though she was allergic, I had gone to Mom's garden to pick flowers to make a bouquet for her. I thought I could tie it with a ribbon to hang upside down outside her window. Then the flowers would dry and she would be able to look at them every day until she got better. But when I'd reached to pick some of the wild lavender that grew around our house, white threads had wormed from my fingers and reached for the plant. I'd been so scared I'd fallen over backward and screamed. When I'd looked at my hands again, the threads were gone.
"What were they?"
I had asked my mom, starting to cry again.
"What's wrong with me? Am I going to get sick like Erin?"
The thought would almost have been a comfort. I'd always felt guilty for being the healthy one. I remembered my mom had covered her mouth with her hand, her eyes wide and frightened. I didn't understand until what happened with Jason Dunn that she was frightened of me. I lifted my gaze to Rebecca's. "A long time ago, she told me I was different from other people, that I had a dangerous gift and I could never use it. She said I..." I stopped, hesitating. Though I had obsessed about what my mom had told me all those years ago, I had never, ever spoken the words out loud, and I was afraid to, as if hearing myself say them would be a turning point from which I could never go back. But then I thought about what I had done to the land around my house and how everything living had died, and I decided I'd already reached the point of no return. She said there were people in this world who could consume a living thing's energy, and that I was one of them, I said. but that it was dangerous to do that because I might hurt someone, and if I did, I might not be able to control my urges after that. She said if I ever felt the urge, I should come and tell her right away. I stopped there, not wanting to explain to the grandmother I'd just met how I had killed my 10-year-old neighbor, drunk his energy like it was a delicious milkshake. Rebecca's eyes darkened.
Anima, she said. That's what we call living energy. In Latin, the word means many things, life or spirit, or sometimes soul. It is all of those things and none of them. But your mom was right about one thing. Taking anima can be dangerous and addictive, but only if you've never been taught control, and in that way your mother failed you inexcusably.
I winced, feeling instinctively protective of my mom, but at the same time part of me wanted to side with Rebecca. In regard to my dangerous gift, the only guidance my mom had given me was don't use it. Rebecca smiled gently at me, as though reading every thought that wound through my head.
Don't worry, Kenna. While you're here, we're going to teach you what it means to be Calyptra.
I chewed my lip, feeling anxiety wriggle beneath that layer of calm. How long do I need to stay here?
As long as it takes.
Can anyone come visit me? I asked, thinking of Blake and Aaron. I'd never spent more than a few days away from home, and I wasn't used to being separated from my twin. And Blake, we were so new, the romantic side of our relationship only a day old. What would happen to us if I didn't see him for a week, a month? What if I wasn't the same person after all this? What if he wasn't either?
I'm afraid not, Rebecca said. We're not accustomed to visitors here, and it wouldn't be safe for you to be around normal people until you've, well, gotten used to your new circumstances.
Not safe for them, you mean? She smiled and stood, looking down at me.
We'll keep you so busy while you're here, you won't have time to miss anyone. Besides, you and I have a lifetime of catching up to do.
I nodded, thinking how much warmer Rebecca's demeanor was than my own mom's. She didn't feel like a grandmother. She felt like the mother I should have had, the woman who should have raised me. But then I felt guilty for thinking such a thing, like I was betraying my real mom. But hadn't she betrayed me by raising me to be normal, by keeping me separated from the people who could have taught me how to be what I was, without hurting anyone else?
It's late, Rebecca said. I'll leave you to sleep. You have a big day tomorrow.
What will I be doing? She cupped my chin in her soft hand and tilted my face so I was looking directly into her eyes. They were the same color as mine, pale green. In the dim room, her pupils were large, crowding out the color of her irises.
Tomorrow, you start over, she said.
Her skin against mine felt warm and charged. A wave of contentment swept through me, unwinding my muscles until I felt limp as a rag doll. Then she released my chin and bent to blow out the lamp. She slipped out the door, leaving me to the cool darkness, with a sense of peace that felt wholly unfamiliar, but like something that should have been familiar, like something I'd been missing for as long as I could remember. As I drifted off, I heard strains of music coming from somewhere outside the house, melodic guitars and hypnotic drums that settled me into a trance-like state, and I thought about how far I felt from the horrors I'd experienced less than a day ago. Now they felt like someone else's nightmare. Cyrus. When I woke in the early morning, there was still music playing, only now it was right outside my door, someone picking softly at the strings of a guitar. With a jolt of alarm, I realized my own guitar was still in the back of Blake's Forerunner, and since visitors were not allowed at Eclipse, I would not have access to it until I went home again, whenever that would be. For me, that was like being separated from a limb or a vital organ, or my twin, or my asthma inhaler, or, oh no, my inhaler. Another thing I'd left behind, another thing I needed to survive. Anxiety pinched my airways, and I immediately began to wheeze. The tranquility I'd enjoyed during my conversation with Rebecca the night before was gone. All the old anxieties and fears and guilt had returned, and along with them came the knowledge that I had been forsaken by my own mother. She had dropped me off in this strange place and left me without so much as a goodbye, without my inhaler, without my guitar, without my twin, and without my boy. Now it was just me and a colony of complete strangers. Worst of all, the empty feeling that had plagued me yesterday was back, coupled with a straining sense of hunger like a wolf on a leash fighting to break free. It wasn't as bad as it had been yesterday. The physical symptoms, the aching, fever-chilled, shuddering madness, were still held at bay. But I had a feeling this respite wouldn't last. Whatever it was Rebecca had fed me from the jar, anima, she called it, I needed more. Still wheezing, I climbed out from under the quilt, shivering at the chilly bite in the air. Someone had left a pile of folded clean clothes on the short dresser next to the bed, but I didn't bother with them, choosing to remain in the ash-gray t-shirt and dark gray